Welcome back to the podcast. Hyundai's lowering the N price. California backs off incentives and Tesla's robo-taxi crashes. On EV News China today, we're talking about BYD in Spain. The NIO ES8 demand surges and Zeekr 001 with its 12C charge rate. Join me later for a bonus show called BMW's Baffling Bet on Hydrogen. It'll be live tonight for patrons, and all Patreon exclusives go into the free feed after 7 days. If you want the content first, though, you're welcome to support the work that I do. And this is how I earn a living these days, via the Patreon platform. And if not, wait a week. It'll drop into the free feed for you to listen to. Let's kick off now. Hyundai just made high-performance EV driving even more accessible to more buyers with a pricing move on the Hyundai Ioniq 5N. The Korean automaker launched the Essential trim that cuts $1,500 from the entry price but keeps every core performance component that really defines the N brand experience. The Essential trim maintains the Ioniq 5N's powertrain, so dual high-output electric motors, the advanced battery system, and the specialized N performance features that deliver the driving dynamics enthusiasts expect. They really reworked that vehicle from an engineering perspective to give it the proper chops of, you know, track day car and enthusiast car. Hyundai did remove what they say is non-essential luxury items while preserving the necessary convenience and safety tech and the ADAS systems. The trim addition positions the Ioniq 5N Essential at about $55,000 equivalent. They're launching it in Korea to begin with, creating a more accessible entry point for drivers wanting the authentic N performance experience. Fleet managers and performance-oriented buyers now have a more cost-effective way into electric vehicle technology that's really high performance without sacrificing the engineering bits but giving up a few luxuries. I wonder if doing that also saves a bit of weight on the vehicle as well. I couldn't find comparable weights for this Essential trim, but interesting that they're doing that now. Maybe we'll get that outside of Korea soon. California's next. The governor there, Gavin Newsom, confirmed the state will not replace the $7,500 federal EV tax credit ending in 7 days' time, citing cost limits despite the calling the rollback vandalism at a federal level. Automakers like Rivian, Hyundai, and Volkswagen have been pushing for a state rebate of $5,000, but instead California will direct funding to charging infrastructure, like the $55 million Fast Charge California project that covers full installation costs for public fast chargers. Okay, I'll just chip in my editorial opinion here. That's kind of a good deal, because I'm not saying everyone in California is earning a lot of money, and clearly they're not, but should we be giving money off cars, or if we want to create an ecosystem, if there's public money, what about a charging infrastructure that needs to be built? If there is public money to be spent, I think that's a really sensible way of spending it. Hey, look, I want cheaper cars for you and I, but, you know, some of that money gets soaked up sometimes by people who could have afforded the full price. Some people argue that some of that money gets soaked up a little bit by the car makers themselves. And so, well, this decision matters because California accounts for 27% of all US EV sales. It's the most important single market for manufacturers. Companies had hoped state incentives would soften the loss of the federal support. Newsom used the announcement to press his clash with automakers. He accused General Motors of abandoning California by opposing its 2035 ban on new pure combustion cars after initially supporting it. GM argues that stricter emissions rules and expensive EV options limit consumer affordability, while California regulators estimate the ban would cut greenhouse gas emissions by 35%. Road transport is the single biggest contributor to emissions. Though rejecting rebates for now, Newsom signaled future incentives could emerge through California's carbon trading revenues, which generate hundreds of millions yearly for clean air programs. Now, Tesla's Austin robo-taxi pilot is facing scrutiny. Just 10 days after launch, three crashes had occurred, and involving its dozen or so modified Model Ys. By then, by early July, the fleet had logged 7,000 miles. But that's not a lot when you think about it. That raises concerns about the system's readiness. The incidents varied in cause. In the first, a Tesla was rear-ended whilst stopped, pointing to external fault. The second proved more serious when one of the Tesla robo-taxis struck a stationary object, causing injury. and then had to be towed. The third saw another Tesla robo-taxi hit from behind while it was moving, though details on who at fault is unclear. A major point of contention, though, focuses on Tesla's use of safety staff. The company insists that no safety drivers were present, but admitted safety monitors sit inside the car with emergency stop controls and access to the steering. While not positioned in the driver's seat itself, these monitors effectively serve the same role. Industry analysts suggest that this framing may downplay the level of human oversight involved, giving the technology an appearance of greater autonomy than it really has. Also, Tesla using every law that they're allowed to, or regulation they're allowed to redact as much possible information about this. Now, that's worth saying, by the way, that their competitors, the likes of the Waymos of the world, actually publish any incident information more than they have to in terms of raising the public's understanding, raising everyone's understanding of autonomous vehicles. Tesla's competitors go over and above in sharing what they actually have to, so that we all have a greater understanding of what happened in an incident, how it can be prevented. Again, Tesla using, I think, you know, I can't blame them if they'll play by the rules, but redacting everything they possibly can about these crashes so that we know little information, but a bumpy start, I guess you could say. Now, some good news for buyers wanting to buy a Tesla. Obviously, we have a week to go till the $7,500 federal EV tax credit goes, but buyers have more time than they thought. The IRS clarified that contracts signed by next week are what matter, not the vehicle delivery. Anyone who pays cash or finances needs a signed binding agreement and a nominal deposit before the deadline of next week. Delivery can follow months later, with the full $7,500 federal tax credit still applying when your taxes are filed. I don't think you could probably take a delivery in a year's time, because your taxes will have been filed, but I'm not sure what the deadline is. I did have a look, couldn't find any obvious answer. There is some consensus around the end of the year being a date. This gives shoppers, though, much greater flexibility to pick the model, colour and features that you really want, rather than having to grab either what's in Tesla inventory or on dealer lots. Tesla updated its guidance this week online, changing the wording from delivery by September 30th to ordering by September 30th. And its sales teams are now reaching out to explain that factory orders that arrive in 2026 would qualify, as long as the paperwork is done this month. The same rule applies to the used tax credit as well, the $4,000. Now, this is really interesting. The online hacker, who I've told you about many times on the podcast, Green the Only, finding evidence of supercharging queuing, a virtual queuing system in Tesla's new over-the-air update, hidden behind what's called a flag. The code and graphical assets in the build suggest that the feature could well be rolled out soon. The discovered functionality would let Tesla owners remotely join, leave, and rejoin waitlists if a supercharger is busy, allowing drivers to hold a spot without actually having to physically wait in line. You go back to the early days and when superchargers would fill up, sometimes there'd be a list of cars and who is next. And then if you were looking after the list when you charged and left, you'd pass it on to the next Tesla driver. Obviously, when the community was much smaller, these days, queuing can be a real problem. Well, you know, life is full of all sorts of people, and then some people don't take their turn always, and it can cause friction at not just Tesla superchargers, but they tend to be the busier ones around holiday periods and things like that. In June, Tesla's global director of charging said the company had started pressure testing its virtual queuing system. Images from the update show UI icons changing from a generic reload symbol to a lightning car combination, indicating tighter interaction with Tesla's charging interface. Tesla's been developing virtual supercharger lineups for quite a period of time, with much of the framework present in this new production build of the over-the-air update. That could be coming soon. I would certainly be very welcome before holiday season, wouldn't it? All right, let's talk about Porsche. Loads of headlines this week about Porsche, and boy, have I seen some misreporting. Porsche's adjusting its EV timeline, delaying full EV rollouts and extending the life of some combustion and hybrid models across the lineup. The shift centres on the upcoming three-row K1 SUV, which will also launch with engines rather than being all electric. The 718 Boxster and the Cayman will also remain combustion powered in their performance trims, with electric versions postponed. Porsche's next generation EV platform has been moved back from its 2030 target. While the Macan is the only model slated for a direct replacement, that's now due as a plug-in hybrid in 2 years' time. Several pressures are shaping this move. Rising US import tariffs, of course, have to play a part in cost barriers, don't they? China's luxury car market slowing a little bit. The global EV adoption is happening at different places around the world. It's not uniform. As a result, Porsche expects to spend $3.65 billion this year on restructuring their roadmap, which will incur more expenses. For enthusiasts, the update means Porsche's combustion engines will be available for longer, while the company shifts to a more measured EV rollout. Instead of chasing aggressive timelines, Porsche says it will align its EV transition with the market. Look, this is entirely sensible, and the way that I saw it reported today was, and the last 2 days, really breathless. Breathless reporting saying Porsche is abandoning EVs. They're absolutely not. The Taycan is a fabulous vehicle. The Macan is a fabulous vehicle. The upcoming Cayenne will blow your socks off, because I know people that have driven it and it blew their socks off. But we can't talk about that yet because it's we're not allowed to. And so Porsche is very much all in on electric vehicles. But if the battery technology is a few years away on a two-seater sports car, or at least a small, fast car that has all of the Porsche values, the Ferrari values, the Lamborghini, McLaren values, why would we rush these performance cars into an EV world? Because there's plenty of performance cars in the world. We're going to talk about one plenty in a minute. And so, yeah, I'm not fully convinced about all the headlines I saw, which is, you know, Porsche is backing away from electric vehicles. Porsche's changing their timeline. But what's wrong with that? Why would they stick stubbornly to something that needs adjustment over time? I don't understand it personally, but maybe I'm missing something. I normally am, to be honest with you, but so much reporting today saying, you know, one version of events. And when you look at the actual facts, they're just adjusting the timeline. And some EVs will come later. Some cars will stick with combustion or hybrid power. Why not offer everything to everybody whilst they want to buy it? The EVs are better. I just don't lose any sleep over it. It's like people that say, why aren't you going online and arguing with people on, you know, Twitter or any of the others and all that? Because I haven't got the energy for it anymore, because EVs are coming, they're better, they're here, everyone will be driving one in a period of time. That time frame is elastic, and it will get stretched and it will contract according to the market. But anyone that wants to stay on driving a diesel car in 20 years' time, I say they're really welcome to it, and I wish them all the best. But it's not for me. I'm guessing it's not for you. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk Lucid Gravity Inventory, a Gladiator plug-in hybrid, and a very, very fast BYD. Stick around. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the podcast. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Lucid Gravity's inventory. 2 days ago, 3 days ago, Lucid added Gravities to their website, and in less than 24 hours' time, they were all gone. So Lucid's global communications chief, Nick Tork, said the listing is not a demand-related development. While we've been building Gravity vehicles to order and satisfy existing customer demand, we produced a number of configurations based on component availability, ensuring we didn't lose production slots when parts were constrained. And they put them into the inventory, and then they all sold out. Again, by looking online, you would think that the world has ended because Lucid put some cars into inventory, which obviously means, according to some people, nobody wants to buy a Lucid. Well, then there you go. 24 hours later, they were all gone. There weren't many of them. And yeah, like if you can get the parts for a build that hasn't been reserved because it's a specific configuration, why waste a build slot? Very strange. Jeep has cancelled plans for a plug-in hybrid version of the Gladiator midsize pickup. As customers' preferences for BEV trucks evolve, Stellantis is reassessing its product strategy and will no longer include a plug-in hybrid Gladiator in the Jeep lineup, said the company. They've notified suppliers of the cancellation, but will continue investing in the Gladiator. The pickup will remain in production through 2028. The Gladiator 4xe plug-in hybrid was going to come this year, joining the Wrangler and Grand Cherokee that have offered plug-in hybrids for many years. Planning and production timelines for the new variant were delayed multiple times, where the Gladiator and Wrangler are built, the UAW, the Workers' Union, prompting doubts about whether the hybrid would ever arrive to support work at the plant. Now, Kia's EV4 is in production. They've started assembling the EV4 hatchback version at their factory in Europe, marking the first EV produced over here. The Autoland plant in Zillena is Kia's sole EV production facility in Europe. They use advanced robotics, employ 3,500 people. An automated production line allows the site to build internal combustion engines or all electric cars at the same time. Vehicle handling was tuned at the European Technical Centre in Germany to give the EV4 a European feel on the roads. They say pre-launch validation cars involved 70,000-mile public road simulations and some Nürburgring stress testing. At the end of that, the battery health had gone from 100% to 95%. I'll take that degradation all the time. Now, Hyundai Motor America is recalling your Arniq 6. So if you have one, the Arniq 6, which shares the platform with the Arniq 5, has a problem with its charge port door panels. They can detach. The defect stems from insufficient engagement between the charging flap and the retaining hooks on the outer panel. If this affects you, they fixed the issue now, by the way, with new cars, but anything potentially, about 31,000 cars sold in the US from 2023 through 2025, your dealer will sort it out. Volvo ran its first public crash test using three electric vehicles in one crash. They used the EX90. Oh, they could have used two and given me one. Now, the test went beyond the regulatory requirements and recreated scenarios that no current safety rating currently enforces them to test. In the sequence, the first car approached the second EX90 at 31 miles an hour, but braked to a complete stop. It avoided contact. The EX90's city safety system brought the vehicle to a stop. A third car, travelling at 34 miles an hour, then struck the second car on the side, hitting the centre of the passenger compartment where occupants sit. The car engaged its safety cage, it says, that helped transfer the loads while managing to deform and absorb the energy from the crash. Of course, the side airbags and inflatable curtains were activated, says the senior technical director at Volvo Cars, Thomas Broberg. Data from the vehicles and crash test dummies indicated there would have been no serious injuries by recreating what is a real-life situation, but isn't required by the actual tests themselves. Volvo, it goes without saying how big into safety Volvo are talking a lot about how they can learn from all of the sensors that record crashes in a modern Volvo EV like the EX90, and then maybe using AI or modelling to work out what could we have done differently to make that even safer. It's a fine line to tread, isn't it? Because you don't admit liability. Like, could we have done something different that would have saved, I don't know, an injury or even a life when you think about it? But I also like their attitude, which is when there is a crash, we do get all of the data back at Volvo and we're spending time working out, right, when we build our new vehicles, what could we have done differently? And it's a really smart way of approaching safety whilst not admitting that we did anything wrong, as it were, in that situation. Right, Rivian's Adventure Network now lets non-Rivian EVs charge at 100 locations. That's about 80% of the network. Rivian Roma lists 128 deployed Rivian Adventure Network, RAN, sites, with a total of 811 DC fast chargers. The 100th site open to all EVs is in Arizona, expected to open the other 28 stations, most on the West Coast by the end of this year. Rivian's been replacing the existing dispensers with replacement units that support non-Rivian EVs and high-voltage systems to deliver 300 kilowatts of power. But that's nothing compared to what this next chart, this car can do. We'll finish off with BYD's performance premium brand, the Yangwang U9 Extreme. It's a Chinese all-electric hypercar from the Yangwang brand. They reached 308.4 miles an hour on the Papenburg test track in Germany. So this is just a huge track. They come around the banking at the, you know, before the long straight at a pretty big lick anyway. Then they use that long straight to completely floor it. Now, weeks ago, BYD drove the 3,000 horsepower or 2,220 kilowatts U9 track edition to set a record, an EV record of 293 miles an hour. That's 472. They returned to the test track with a new version of the U9 called the U9 Extreme. So this uses a 1,200-volt ultra-high-voltage platform. And they use LFP batteries. Yeah, we used to be put in buses. It's like the ugly sister of battery technology. No, LFP packs in the world's fastest car. And that's right, because this beats a Bugatti Chiron Special Edition to now become the world's fastest production car. And they will produce this. By the way, they're going to make 30 of them, the Extreme U9s. Just incredible. It's a source of real Chinese pride as well, because I was going to try and make a bonus podcast soon about the Chinese cars that are coming here and how they're taking on the high end of the market. And obviously, one of the things is, you can't get away from it, is the name. So the name Yangwang doesn't necessarily translate immediately for Western buyers, but it's a source of huge Chinese pride. If there is a direct translation, it's closest to meaning looking up or admiring in English, expressing ideas of admiration, aspiration, and the spirit of exploring. And again, for a Chinese speaker or anyone very proud to symbolize the innovation of their country and setting new records, obviously it's a huge thing. They'd be really upset that somebody would... And obviously there is like a schoolboy slang part of the Yangwang name that we won't get into. The other one is Denza they have. How does that translate? I've not got anywhere with it really, because you start to get into like cultural differences and respecting people's cultures. And I don't know, it just gets a little bit icky away from electric vehicles. So I've not found a good way of describing it yet and finding the right words. But either way, who cares what the car is called? This is now the world's fastest production car, 308.4 miles an hour, 496.2 kilometres an hour. It's close to 500, isn't it? It's close to 500 kilometres an hour. I wonder why they didn't aim for or couldn't do the 500. What a ridiculous thing for me to say, like as if he didn't, you know, like in a movie when someone just puts their foot down a little bit more in a car chase and the car bursts forward. Like that's how I imagine it is. Go on, go a bit faster and do 500 kilometres an hour. Crazy. At this speed, you are just approaching the physics of rubber and keeping four small contact patches and the car going in a straight line. So at this point, we're not really against the mechanical side. It's the engineering of tyres and things, but fascinating. Right, that's our podcast for today. Thanks to our premium partners, Porsche of the Village in Cincinnati, Audi of Cincinnati East, and Volvo Cars of Cincinnati East, National Car Charging on the US mainland, and Aloha Charge in Hawaii, and Octopus Electroverse, global public charging made simple with one app and one map. Have a good one, see you tomorrow, and remember, there's no such thing as a self-charging hybrid.